so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome, everybody, to the most empowering show on the radio, the show that proves that you don't have to settle for your life the way that it is, that you can do the things that you love, face your challenges head on, and start down the path of living the life you've always wanted. It's called Growing Bolder, and I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. Right now, we hope to inspire you by letting you listen to the incredible stories of world-renowned experts, best-selling authors, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives.
Yeah, Growing Bolder is more than a radio show, folks. It's also a national TV show, a magazine, and a website, all of which offer hope, inspiration, and possibility for your life. So hang with us for the next hour as we pay a visit today to Gilligan's Island to talk with Marianne herself. Then we'll check in with a 90-year-old legend of the Broadway stage. And also, we'll hear how a woman born into poverty is changing the lives of inner-city children with something that's called Estella's Brilliant Bus. Amazing people, inspiring stories. It's time for Growing Bolder.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
It's one of those theme songs that everybody knows, young and old alike, and very impressive when you realize that Gilligan's Island went on the air a half a century ago. Did you know it only ran for three seasons, but once it hit syndication, it has never stopped running?
And why should it? Yeah, and guess what, folks? We have one of the castaways with us now because she has written a fabulous new book that not only takes us back to the days of our youth, but also brings us up to this very moment by asking an interesting question. In this day and age, what would Mary Ann do? That's the title of the latest book from Mary Ann herself, Miss Dawn Wells. Hey, Dawn, how are you?
I am just terrific. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Congratulations on a tremendous career, a fabulous new book. Gilligan's Island premiered 50 years ago. How the heck did that happen? And not only are we still talking about it, but everybody still knows the show and knows who you are. That's got to feel great.
We have never been off the air since 1964, the longest running show in television syndication, and in 30 languages. Can you imagine?
And think of all the money you've made in residuals over the years.
Don't I wish I'd have made 10 cents.
Yeah, what was the deal back then, Dawn? I think it was maybe for one rerun or maybe five or less.
I think they did. Well, there was no rerun contracts or anything when we went on the air.
Wow.
And I think it was Gunsmoke, Jim Darness's agent said, listen, if you're going to run this again, you're going to have to pay somebody. So it started it. And I think we probably maybe for the first 6 months, and it never went on anymore. I mean, I know a lot of other shows, you know, like MASH and stuff like that. I'm quoting. I don't know anything about MASH, but took it to court and you can't. I mean, there was no contract there. Mr. Howell was very bitter about it. I said, but it didn't exist. You wouldn't want color television if they didn't know what it was. So, I mean, it didn't exist then, and it's a shame. When you see some of the stuff today, they get $1 million an episode just to film.
Yeah, it is amazing how times have changed, but yet Gilligan lives on. And have you figured it out yet, Dawn? What is it about that show? Why do we still talk about it? Why do we still love it?
Well, I think it's because, one thing, it's timeless. No cars, no clothes, no telling you when it was filmed. So you're not looking at something that you think is dated. A kid 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 years old thinks it's happening for the first time. I think that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is, it was wholesome, of course, but it's seven misfits trying to get along. And that's what the world is today. How many continents all trying to get along? And you take, you know, the millionaire and the bumbling Gilligan and all of that coping without any anger, no bullying, with no animosity, everybody trying to pitch in. And I think that's sort of a healthy thing. We wish that we all could be doing that again, kind of. I don't know. And it was beautiful to film. We were the first sitcom out of the living room.
Right.
We were the first sitcom in short shorts. So it kind of broke some standards, so to speak. And I guess it's almost like, you know, you sit and watch The Three Stooges sometimes or Charlie Chaplin sometimes. I thought Gilligan was extremely, his physical comedy was wonderful. It was nonsensical. You couldn't help but say, oh, my gosh, a jungle boy comes on the island and doesn't know where he is. I mean, I think you sort of tongue in cheek, even when it was happening, you know, 30 years ago.
You know, it's kind of funny, Dawn. One change, I think, in society is back when you guys were filming, I'm guessing there were probably a lot more Marianne's in real life than there were Gingers, and now I think everything's flipped.
It has, exactly, and that's one of the reasons I kind of wrote the book. It isn't a goody-two-shoe book at all. It's just saying times have changed, and when we went on the island, the birth control pill wasn't invented. So if you had Marianne on that on all this time and then dropped her in, she was a farm girl raised with good, you know, good morals and good work ethic and so on. Whoa, what would be happening? Now you have mothers and fathers that most of them have to work. You have a couple of marriages with stepchildren, et cetera. The kids go in the room and shut the door and get on the internet or whatever happens. It's very hard to be a parent today, and it's very hard to be somebody growing up or a father of a 13-year-old. Even if you're 13 or 14 and you don't want to be part of that Kardashian stuff or everything, or you get criticized because you aren't beautiful and all those things. I mean, I think it's very difficult to raise children today. And it's I'm very proud of the book because it's kind of, it's not tongue-in-cheek, but it's a light read. I mean, you can flip through it and find a category like if you don't succeed, fail, fail again. What does that mean? You know, it means that just keep trying. Or if you started a job, finish a job. And what it's going to be like with all the tattoos you're putting on your arm. When you're 50 years old, are you happy that there's a parrot on your chest? You know, I think these things have to be sort of addressed, and kids really aren't doing it. I think it's a great book for Christmas. It's small. Stick it in the Christmas stocking. Read it with your 13-year-old. Read it with your 14-year-old boy. I have a godson that at 14, first crush, you know, came out of the bedroom and said to his mother, "My girlfriend just sent me a picture of her topless. What do I do?" Now, how nice that he came in and confronted his mother about it, and they called the girl's mother, and they had a conversation before that poor girl had that set all over the world. So it's much more difficult. Both parents are working. So I because I've met so many fans who bring their kids with them, you know, 12, 14, 15, say, "I married a Marianne. She's the one I wanted to marry, not Dawn Wells, but that character that would pitch in with you and help you and good sense of humor and kindness and all those things that we forget about." And I think it's I'm very proud of it because I really do think it's a message we need without being preachy, you know?
Folks, if you haven't figured it out, we are talking with Dawn Wells, who, of course, played Marianne for years on Gilligan's Island. She's written a fabulous new book, really a great concept. It's called What Would Marianne Do? And I guess, Dawn, a perfect segue, you know, into a question. You know, guys always say Ginger or Marianne. So let me ask you, what would Marianne do, Gilligan or the professor, Mr. Howe or the skipper?
Hands down, the professor.
The professor.
No question. He was handsome and really off camera. He had the best sense of humor.
And we just lost Russell Johnson not long ago, too.
Yes, we did, almost a year ago.
You know, Dawn, I think you sort of underestimate things a little bit. Marianne definitely is a role model in an endearing, timeless kind of a way, but so's Dawn Wells. I mean, you've always had such a great attitude in every interview we've ever seen you in over the years, even. You never had that fight about not wanting to identify with your character. No, you're not the goody-two-shoes that Marianne is, but you've been phenomenal in who you are, and you've helped us love Marianne even more.
That's very sweet of you, and I really do think I am. I was raised in Reno, Nevada, with prostitution and gambling and divorce by a mother who was a Marianne mother. And I realized, you know, I didn't run out and get out and get into trouble. Kids are drinking now like they didn't do, but we didn't have internet like then. But I think those values, that moral compass, is now all over the place. You as a parent don't have the power over that internet stuff. And I was raised as a Marianne, and I think I'm an optimist. I really am. I believe in, you know, the best of everything, or you can make it the best it can be. And when I was writing the book, you sort of wonder who you are. I've not spent a lot of hours thinking about it. But when I started talking about what I did, I had my knees dislocate. So I couldn't do any sports. I never got that wonderful thing being part of a team or beating somebody in tennis because of my knees. But I was a debater. Hence, maybe it's one of the reasons I became an actress. But I was sitting as I was writing the book thinking, you know, what is it about debate that fascinated me? Because you look at both sides. You have to prepare both sides of the case. Do you believe in abortion or don't you believe in abortion? And you have to prepare the case on either side because you don't know what you're going to draw when you're starting to debate somebody. And I think I look at that way on life. What's the worst that can happen? What's the other side of this? And I think that's given me a healthy attitude. I mean, these people who are all about bad rapping the roles that they got cast, doggone it. I mean, Purnell Roberts was awful with Bonanza. I mean, you were lucky enough to get a part. don't, you're jeopardizing everybody else's jobs. The caterer, the grip, the writers, the cameramen, all are connected with that show. How dare you then get on and say, I hate the show? Don't take it. Give it to another actor. If you don't want to be identified with it, then don't do it.
You know, these legendary, iconic shows, Dawn, of which there's really only a handful, and Gilligan's Island is one of them, that they play incessantly. I think we all have the impression that thousands of episodes were shot. How many original episodes of Gilligan's Island were shot, and when did they cancel it? What was that like?
Well, I think we did 39 episodes a year, which now you're lucky if you get 15. You know, we only had 2 months off. That's very different now. And we weren't in color the first year. And what was the last question you asked me?
Why did they cancel it?
Oh, when we were renewed, I mean, we were in the top 10. Nobody would do that anymore. We were renewed for fourth year. We were actually going to go to Hawaii and shoot. And this is what I have been told. Now, I can't swear on a stack of Bibles. But Sherwood called us, our producer called us in the middle of May and said, well, we've been dropped. And we said, what? Well, they had a half hour that they needed to fill. They had bought a Dennis Weaver show, and they had a half hour that they needed to fill, and they couldn't find a show. So they decided to cancel Gunsmoke and put us in after the first half-hour show that they'd sold. And Mr. Paley was president of CBS at the time, and his wife came home from vacation and said, what do you mean you canceled Gunsmoke? That's my favorite show. So he canceled us.
Wow. Hey, Dawn, before we go, we got about 30 seconds left, and I don't want to let you go without talking about this since we are growing bolder. Is life in your mid-70s, is it good?
It's great. It's great. I did a Lion in Winter last summer. I'm doing a pilot in January. I'm working. I'm not married. I don't have children. I'm not a grandma. So I love what I do, and I'm healthy, and I'm crossing my fingers. I'm going to be Betty White when I grow up.
Well, you know, you're a fabulous Dawn Wells as it is. The book is called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life by the always interesting Dawn Wells. Please check it out. We could certainly use a little bit of that Marianne perspective in the world today. Thanks so much to a class act, Dawn Wells. Up next, he was an ordinary 14-year-old. How being diagnosed with cancer helped him become extraordinary. Next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
Even when we're growing bolder, we can all use a ride every now and then. Did you know that many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats like groceries and OTC medication? Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584. You know, Bill, I love this segment. Time now, folks, for our Surviving and Thriving feature. With the right support, the right attitude, it is possible to not just survive life's greatest challenges, but to actually thrive.
And, Mark, this week it's about a young man who was diagnosed with cancer, what he saw while in the hospital, and what he decided to do about it. These are what childhood memories should be. A brother and a sister, sharing adventures, making discoveries, experiencing the world. But life doesn't always work that way. Benji Watson was about to have a whole different set of memories, memories that would change him forever.
One morning I woke up and I was just feeling awful, and my parents took me to the ER, and that's when we found out that it was cancer.
The attending physician, the ER doctor, comes out, pulls us out of the room and says, you know, we're 99% sure your son has cancer. He has a mass the size of a grapefruit in his chest.
Excuse me. Benji had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
I was surprised. I wasn't really feeling anything at the moment. I was just in disbelief and couldn't really understand what was going on.
His pediatric oncologist, Fouad Hajjar, knew Benji was in trouble.
He presented with a large chest mass, so that alone is pretty significant because it can give you that feeling of choking. It can, and I, as I recall, he wasn't able even to lay down. He was always trying to sit up. At the time, it was difficult for him to breathe, so we had to make the diagnosis quickly.
I mean, we were all, like, devastated. And he, you know, well, I remember the first thing him saying, well, he said, I'm going to be a cancer survivor. That was his first words out of his mouth. When we sat there with him, you got cancer? He goes, well, then I'm going to be a cancer survivor. He was the strongest of all of us, without a doubt.
The pain is so raw, the tears still flow. But if you spend any time around the Watson family, you quickly learn that they are fighters. Something else, something that turned out to be extremely effective in their fight against cancer. They pulled together and focused all their time and energy on being there for Benji.
What does it feel like to be that kid, you know, laying in that hospital?
Makes you feel like you're all alone. It's like no one understands what you're going through. But you have people there with you, it really helps. It makes you feel like you're going to be okay.
It was then that Benji turned his attention away from himself and towards other patients.
What did you see? What did you notice?
Well, I just had an overwhelming amount of support from all my friends and family in school. And any given day, I had 30 visitors on the floor, and there was, at any time, hundreds of children being treated for the same thing I had, but put together, they didn't have half the amount of people visiting them that I had, and I just thought that wasn't okay.
Benji saw that many were alone, not because nobody cared, but because their parents couldn't be there. Most have to work to pay the bills. They still have to attend to their other children and other responsibilities. Many have no choice, even though children need their parents to help them fight.
Having the support around you makes things a lot easier. You can tolerate chemotherapy better. You feel better. You can ignore the little things like a little headaches or a little pain, a little needle stick here and there. But if you don't have anybody around you, you're alone, it's not an easy process.
Benji made a vow that when he got healthy, he'd come back and do something to make a difference.
Hey.
How are you doing, Benji?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
Nice seeing you again.
Mm-hmm.
Looking sharp.
Thank you.
I really saw that, hey, if you have the ability to do something, you have an obligation to help people. And even if you're only one person can make a difference. It all starts with the tiniest little drop, and it ripples out from there.
Even if you're 14 and in the hospital fighting cancer yourself.
So he started the Benji Watson Cancer Foundation and dedicated himself to holding fundraising events to help allow parents to be right by their child's side by covering some critical expenses.
The gas cards, the food cards, the electric bills, the rent bills, those are items the insurance companies don't cover. I mean, that's the biggest need. I mean, we get, three, four, five requests a week.
This foundation is something that you don't see every day. People coming out of this kind of experience and creating that kind of powerful movement that would help many other families, hundreds of them.
In just the first few years, Benji's foundation has raised over $200,000. It's helped hundreds of families, all because of the need we all have for support, even doctors.
But as an oncologist, you need everybody else that's around you. You need the surgeon, you need the pathologist, you need the respiratory therapist, you need the intensivist, you need the child life. You've seen these stories before, you've heard it already from Benji Watson. You need a whole team of people around you. And I have that team here. I'm blessed to have that team here at Florida Hospital for Children.
You're very emotional still about telling your story. Where is that coming from? What is that?
It's not really a sadness. It's more of a happiness that I have so many wonderful people in my life that are willing to help me. Just all the memories of constantly being with people, people always being there for me.
So Ben, what do you want to do now? You're getting ready to go to college. What do you want to do with your life?
I hope to grow my foundation to get it as big as I can possibly get it and just continue to help as many people as we can.
this you think now is going to be your life's calling?
Mm-hmm. Certainly is going to be involved in my life for a long day, long way to go.
What an amazing young man, and good for Benji Watson for trying to make a difference. If you'd like to learn more, just go to bensvoice.org.
Life sure can be easier when you know exactly what your calling is. Some people just know what they want to do and focus on nothing else.
Yeah, they're the lucky ones. But what do you do when you're just not sure, when you like a lot of different things, but nothing particularly jumps out at you? Well, here's something we think might help.
Hi, I'm Gary McKechnie, a former ad copywriter who decided to start Growing Bolder. Now I'm a best-selling, award-winning author, humorist, and America's backroads travel expert. My mom had passed away in 1989, and I was just drifting and couldn't nail down what I wanted to do. About 8 months later, on New Year's Eve, as a matter of fact, a friend who I felt was very successful, he got the full force of my wrath. I just laid into the sky about all of the things he had accomplished. So he asked me what I wanted to do, and I rattled off a few things. I said, oh, I want to write a movie, be on Saturday Night Live, I want to get a PhD. And then he said, well, what have I done to accomplish any of that? I hadn't done anything, actually. And so my excuse was I wanted to do so many things, I never moved forward on anything. So he said, look, if you had $1 million in the bank and woke up tomorrow, you didn't have to worry about work or having a career, what would you do? And all of a sudden, I was able to take money and ambition out of the equation. I said, I would travel and I would write. He said, that was it. That was my passion. Aside from any other consideration, that's what I really wanted to do. And he was right, I did. I became a travel writer. I was writing articles. I wrote the best-selling motorcycle guidebook in America. I've written 2 books for National Geographic, and I leveraged that to speak on ships, the Cunard's Queen Mary II and Queen Victoria, and on the Seabourn Sojourn. And that was a great lesson. If you can determine what you really want to do, everything else is just noise.
Up next, how a woman raised in poverty is changing lives with a brilliant bus. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
Here the soldier stands, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach.
You are listening to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark, that's Bill, and this is the program, folks, where we get guests to come on and talk about how they have changed their lives and ended up making a difference in the lives of others. And our next guest did it without a lot of money, without any powerful contacts, and really, Bill, without much help at all.
She is amazing. She spent 50 years as a teacher of kids and adults, too. She's worked with the mentally challenged, the underprivileged, even abused kids. Well, she retired, but the need was so great, you know what she did? She came back to help some more. And then she had this big idea, so important, she sunk all of her retirement money into making it a reality. The result? Something amazing called Estrella's Brilliant Bus. Let's say hi to Estella Pyfrom. Hey, Estella.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Oh, we're awesome, and we're anxious to hear about the Brilliant Bus. What is that?
The Brilliant Bus is a mobile learning center that I built from scratch with an idea, and it's designed to take technology into the underserved neighborhoods.
You know, and aren't you something great for doing this, Estella? Because, I mean, you're in retirement. Aren't you supposed to be sitting on the couch eating pork rinds and drinking a hot toddy?
Well, there's a saying that says, if you enjoy what you're doing, you never worked a day in your life. So I'm having as much fun as those people who are just eating the pork rinds and having a cup of tea.
You know what else we think is amazing about you, Estella, is that your whole life is about helping others, despite the fact that you were raised with practically nothing. Nobody would blame you if you were expecting people to help you, but you've done the opposite.
Well, there's a saying, another saying that says it takes a village to raise a child. That experience in the projects where people help each other, I think that experience that goes way back to when I was a girl helped transform me into the person I am today. You know, we thoroughly enjoy and get a feeling of gratitude. I mean, it's just a special feeling that you get from being able to help people that need help. And we target the underserved communities as our target population to provide service.
Folks, are you getting this? This is Estella Pyfrom, who in retirement wanted to make a difference with underprivileged, underserved children. So she created this mobile learning center called Estella's Brilliant Bus. And Estella, as Bill noted, you didn't really have much. So how did you put this together? How were you able to marshal the resources to make a difference?
Well, first of all, I started with an idea. And my dad made us think that if you were willing to work out something very hard, and work through it, plan well, you can make it happen, and that failure was not an option. So what I did is I sat down and came up with a five-year plan, way that I could make it work, make it happen, and then I put that plan into action.
You know, you were spent so many years in the public school system. What are they doing wrong there that your bus is doing right?
I won't say that they're doing so much wrong, but I think I'm doing a lot of so much right. And that is, I think one thing that I could do perhaps as well or better than the public school system, and that is every kid that gets on my bus, I can personalize their learning activities. It is all geared toward individual age and grade level appropriate activities. And because the school system has a class size that they have to be concerned about, it may take them a little bit longer to be able to personalize everything and be able to do that every session.
Estella is teaching us that you don't need a lot to make a big difference. And I think she's also teaching us that you're never too old to make a difference. Estella, can I ask you how old you are?
I will be 78. December 7th, next month.
78, and we can hear the lovely sound of children in the background. Are those some of your relatives, or are you working with kids today?
Well, I'm working at home today in my office, and the baby's mother is sick. I mean, the babies have been sick, and the mother has been out. All of them had viruses, and since she's used all of her days, I'm working and I'm babysitting.
Estella, that's incredible. While Mark brought up age, let's stay on that topic for just a second. Most people want to help, but feel they're too old to step back in and make a difference. What are your thoughts on age?
I think you are never too old to learn. And I didn't even get interested in technology until I was 7 to 1. And again, back to what my dad said, is that if you want to do something, you set your heart at it, you can do it. You're never too old to learn. So technology is the thing of today. We're in the technology age. So if you really want to learn and get involved with all of the things that you need to do, you best better learn something about technology. So for me, I'm excited about it because I've always liked to put things together. I like innovative things. When I was growing up, and even through my adult years, my kids call me the gadget lady because I'm always looking at new ways of doing things and putting things together and making them work. So this is exciting for me.
Estella, you did this to make a difference, not to make a splash, but son of a gun, you are making a splash. CNN featured you. Oprah loves you. Your story is getting coverage all over the world. How does that feel?
It feels wonderful to know that I am making a difference, and I feel good about it because people from all over the world contact me and give me congratulations, although that's not what I'm working and doing this for. But it helps you get over the idea when people come to you and say, well, people don't appreciate what you're doing. You're doing all of that for nothing. I don't listen to them because I know I'm making a difference.
And just think about that, folks. If Estella can do what she is doing, imagine if we had an army of Estellas out there who care enough about the kids to forego their retirement, to step in, try to make a difference, to get involved in the lives of children. If you were ever wondering, can one person make a difference, Estella is proof that one person can. For more information, or even just to help out, just check out estellasbrilliantbus.org. What an inspiring woman. Thanks so much for everything you do. Up next, you saw his special on PBS. Now, more on the six innovations that changed the world. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Mark Middleton and Bill Schaefer here on Growing Bolder. And Bill, if I may, a question for you.
Sure.
And anybody else out there that's listening that would like to weigh in, name what you think some of the innovations that actually made the modern world are. What would you come up with? What's the most important?
Geez, okay, the internet for sure. What, I guess, you know, the automobile, electricity, the airplane, and the miniskirt?
I can't believe it.
What? That I got them all right?
Actually, you didn't get any of them. And I don't think I would either, because I would have thrown in GPS. I'm a big fan of GPS. But let's put it this way. Don't feel bad, because I think probably everybody out there missed him. Do you know who Stephen Johnson is?
Stephen Johnson, oh yeah.
He is a writer, a columnist, a media theorist, a best-selling author of 8 books, all of which will pretty much blow your mind, especially the latest. So interesting that it's also a 6-part special on PBS. The title, How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World. Can't wait to find out what he thinks they are. Let's welcome Stephen Johnson. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Very, very well. I think Bill's list, the things he came with, or probably came up with, are probably what everybody else out there was thinking. But your list is entirely different. How did you pick yours?
Well, what I wanted to do with this list, and really was kind of a group effort, because we were doing this in concert with the PBS series, was to find objects that are crucial to everyday life and our standards of living and our existence that don't seem like technology anymore, because they've kind of, we're so accustomed to them. So GPS is the internet. We think of those now as innovations because they're kind of new. But we are immensely dependent on things like transparent glass for all these different reasons we can get into, or artificial cold in various forms, refrigeration and air conditioning. Or artificial light, but we're so used to them that we don't think about it anymore. So we wanted to kind of do a different kind of history, where we would take these everyday things and say, listen, behind this object, behind a glass of clean drinking water, there is a whole, you know, 1,000-year history of creativity and innovation and problem solving, and also kind of craziness, because you have to be kind of a little bit insane to invent some of these things, that we all benefit from, but we don't really celebrate that history as much as we should.
And we'll talk about the 6 items that you've chosen, but one of the really interesting things is that your point of view is that sometimes the more technological advances we make, the more they're hidden from us. What's that about?
Well, look, think about GPS. So, people have already gotten completely dependent on GPS, and now nobody has any idea where they are if their phone runs out of battery, and they can't get anywhere. But that technology, I think most people understand that it vaguely involves satellites and things like that, and that it used to belong to the military. But the crucial technology behind GPS is timekeeping. GPS is all about atomic clocks that are accurate to a nanosecond. And basically, what happens with GPS is that your phone or whatever your device is picks up these 3 signals, at least 3, from satellites overhead that are just reporting what time it is. and it's timed down to, you know, a billionth of a second. That's how accurate it is. And because each satellite is a slightly different distance from you, when you receive these timestamps from these satellites, they're slightly different. It's like 8:54 and 36 seconds, 0.00966657778, and the other one is 0.79, and the other one is 0.76. And that's because it takes a certain amount of time for the signal to reach your phone. And so it can calculate the distance that your phone is from each of those satellites because the timekeeping is so accurate. And that's how it's able to tell you where you are down to the level of like a meter. I mean, it's incredibly accurate geographically. But we don't think about clocks as being central to knowing where we are geographically, but that's the way it works.
Can you imagine this guy at a cocktail party? This is Stephen Johnson, folks, who has written a fabulous book, How We Got to Now. He talks about six innovations, and we do want to get to those. But if I'm hearing you right, you know, we're getting distracted by the fruit and not really the seed. In other words, you say that the issue of race relations sprang out of the invention of the radio and that big box stores actually are the result of the invention of the laser. How so?
Well, the first thing that happens with radio is radio, as radio becomes a mass medium in the early 20s and people all across the nation kind of tune in to music for the first time, one of the first things that happens is that jazz becomes a mainstream music in the United States. And it was really just limited to these, you know, kind of Mississippi Delta, New York and Chicago and a few other small places. It was a completely underground music. And radio made it a national thing. And for the first time, you had African Americans who were driving the culture in this way, driving a new sound. You had white Americans listening to African American music. And you had hosts of shows. Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong had their own shows on radio, kind of live from the Cotton Club, all that kind of stuff. And so it was really, you know, if you go back and look at the history of the civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King gave a wonderful speech about this later on, is that jazz was one of the first kind of emissaries where these two cultures, white America and black America, began to kind of share a language, a cultural kind of language, and where the African American side was actually producing it. And without radio, it would have been much harder for that to happen.
All right,
jazz was wonderfully suited for early radio. It kind of punched through the kind of, you know, kind of limited bandwidth of early radio better than, say, classical or opera would have done. So it was a big part of that story.
So now, Stephen, we're kind of getting to how you're approaching this. So let's go to the six innovations that made the modern world. You say they are, you ready, folks? Glass, cold, sound, clean, time, and light. Those are choices I don't think any of us would have picked. Which ones of those surprised you the most?
I guess I would say glass, because we think of glass as you know, windows and, you know, drinking glass, not such a big deal. But if you could kind of wave a magic wand and eliminate all glass from human society, you would not only eliminate windows and windshields and things like that and glass, you know, the glass buildings and skyscrapers we have now, but you would eliminate spectacles. Huge part of the population wouldn't be able to read. You would eliminate telescopes and microscopes and all the scientific understanding and health breakthroughs that came out of being able to see very distant things, very small things. Every lens, every camera lens, every television, every film camera, every fiber optic cable, which is made out of glass fibers, so the internet would disappear, your iPhone screen would disappear. I mean, the world would collapse without glass.
So again, Stephen, it's the inventions behind the inventions that you're pointing out, and that's what makes this book so fascinating. Before we go, I want to ask you one more question. What do you see basically as the takeaway for all of us? What can we learn from those six innovations as a whole that will move us forward in the way we think?
Well, so many of the people that we profile are kind of ordinary folks. They're like it's not big corporate R&D labs. It's kind of these amateurs and tinkerers. And so I hope that it kind of inspires, and I think that particularly the show is a really fun thing to watch as a family with, like, an 11-year-old can really get it, I think. And I hope it inspires a kind of a new generation of folks to go out and innovate, not just starting some new, you know, website, social media company in Silicon Valley, but solving the kind of big problems that we have now that, you know, people solved in the past.
Steve, you're a fascinating guy. I love the way you make us think. You make us take a look at ordinary things and think of them in a completely different way. The book is called How We Got to Now. And as he said, be sure to check out the 6-part PBS special as well. Our thanks to a guy guaranteed to get your creativity flowing, Stephen Johnson. Up next, a 90-year-old Broadway, TV, and movie legend, Theodore Bickel, is coming up on Growing Bolder. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
If I were a rich man, yabba-bee-ba-bee-ba-yabba-ba-bee-ba-bee-ba-bum, all day long I'd biddy-biddy-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to
Never, ever gets old. What a wonderful, talented, brilliant, giving, and timeless performer you're about to hear from. And yes, he is a rich man, but in all the right ways. This is Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and our next guest is a very special human who certainly has made a difference.
He is a distinguished actor on stage, known far and wide as Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. He's had remarkable television roles in shows like Falcon Crest, Murder, She Wrote, and Star Trek Next Generation. And how about movies? Well, he has been in some of the best ever. African Queen with Bogey, My Fair Lady, and The Defiant Ones, in which he was nominated for an Oscar. And the best news of all, folks, he is now in his 90s, still working, still active, still making the world a better place. Let's welcome the living legend himself, Mr. Theodore Bickel. Hey, Theodore, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I call you Theo? Do your friends call you Theo or Mr. Bickel?
Call me Theo.
Theo, I appreciate that. First of all, we mentioned you're 90. And man, we want to celebrate that because you are still getting it done. How does it feel to be you and be 90?
How does it feel to be 90?
Yeah.
I don't know. I get up. I look in the newspaper, and if my name is not in the obituaries, I have breakfast.
You know what's great? You first wrote your autobiography called Theo about 20 years ago, when you were just a kid. You were 70. Instead of slowing down, you've been so active that you've had to keep adding chapters to your book. The most recent one has just come out, so you got to run out and get the book Theo. Isn't it something, sir, that so much has happened since you first wrote the book?
Indeed, I have the book. I have a film also called Theodore Bickel in the Shoes of Sholem Aleichem, which has begun to play at festivals all over. And, I'm a little slower, but I don't stop.
And I think that must be the key. And speaking of not stopping, you were a major player in the folk music scene in the 50s and 60s. You co-founded the Newport Folk Festival. What was it about that era of folk music, Theo, that drew you to it so strongly?
Well, I've always played folk music. I've done it for my own amusement and for that of my friends and my family. When I came to America, all of a sudden, I found myself, America is a strange place because they will not tolerate you doing anything well without forcing you to accept money for it. And so I had an additional career on my hands all of a sudden. But the career aspect was secondary to me. The music was important to me. And so Newport was a natural outcropping of that, because Pete Seeger, George Wein, and I decided that because the youth of the time, at the time, was so fired up with folk music, which tied in that we decided we owed to the folk field a payback, because we learned the music from people, folk singers in the field, who really were poor and just sang, and we learned from them. We felt that we owed them a payback. And so we created Newport, made a lot of money, and we gave that all back.
Well, not only did you make a contribution in music, you've also done it in a theater. After 40 years and over 2,000 performances of Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, you finally hung up your tallis. Do you miss Tevye?
Not really, because the last time I played Tevye was in 2010. That's not so long ago. After that, I decided enough. I gotta hang up my milk pail. For instance, I'm going to be in Washington this weekend. There's a production of Fiddler on the Roof at the Arena Stage, and I'm going to see it with my family, and then there'll be a Q&A with me on stage afterwards. So if I'm not playing it, at least I can talk about it.
We are talking to Theodore Bacall, folks, a living legend now in his 90s who has done it all. And speaking of doing it all, I'm just fascinated that you were in films like African Queen. You are really, one of the last living links to that era of Hollywood. What was Bogey like? Do people still ask you about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I was really in awe over the talent that was there, because we were sitting in the makeup room before we went on the set, and he was mumbling the lines with the script woman, and I said, okay, where is all of that? Half an hour later, we're on the set, and there's a full-blown performance. And I never knew when it came together and how. And it was awesome. It was really great.
And from then to now, Theodore, I think a lot of people would be interested to know how is your marriage going? I think you're still in the newlywed phase. Been married, around 2 years to your beautiful wife, Amy. How's that going?
Very well indeed. I love it. It's phenomenal. I mean, who would have thought that you couldn't get married at this late stage in life? And love it, enjoy it. Good. It's fine.
Theo,
I recommend it to anybody.
We don't let anybody of your stature go without giving us something to think about. I mean, you have experienced life for decades. You've had success. You're still going strong. What can we learn from you about life in general? What is the Theodore Bacall takeaway? What's the moral of your story?
Be curious. Be curious. Look at life. Look at things around you. Find out about them. Read, listen, sing if you can, and if you can't sing, don't sing. but just don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on life. It's there to be enjoyed. It's a gift. Don't squander it.
It's always so interesting to hear from people like Theodore Bacall, because we look back and think, wow, he's a legend. But in his own mind, he worked his way up step by step, opportunity by opportunity. The man took many risks. He followed his heart. He followed what he believed in. And look what happened. He became a legend of the stage, the screen, and the music world. Folks, I encourage you to read his autobiography called Theo. He's just added, not his last chapter, we'll just call it his latest chapter. What a treat to visit with the legendary Theo Bacall.
Mm-hmm. Where did the last hour go? That's it for now, folks. But, you know, Growing Boulder doesn't stop here. In fact, it's really just the beginning. You can find hundreds more interviews just like the ones you've heard today with TV stars, movie stars, rock stars, sports stars, authors, business leaders, medical experts, wellness experts, financial experts, travel experts. But here's my favorite, regular people who have just found their way to live in exciting lives. All of that is at growingboulder.com.
Remember, at Growing Boulder, we're offering three products. They are hope, inspiration, and possibility, and we hope you're buying. Tell some friends about the most unique media company anywhere, and then ask yourself, are you Growing Boulder?
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears.